Welcome to Honorverse Today, the Honor Harrington podcast brought to you by TPE Network. Let's be about it.
Hello there, Honorverse fans. Welcome to our next exciting, thrill-packed, multifaceted, very multifaceted, in fact, this time, episode of Honorverse Today. This is a somewhat ill Raul Wibera being joined by my much less ill good friends, Jim Arrowood and J.P. Harvey. How are the two of you this fine day?
Rip-roaring and ready to go.
Me too, and I'm glad that you're taking the bullet for us, Raul.
Oh, gosh. Sorry I have such little voice. Influenza A, not fun.
But even the flu won't stop.
I've missed chatting with you guys. We already had to postpone once, and I'll be damned if I'm going to do it again. Yeah. But the nature of today's book, actually, you'll be somewhat friendly for that, because we're talking about Challenges, which is the latest anthology to be written. And this is actually sort of a sad book for me in a lot of ways. One, on some of the stories, but two, it's like we're almost coming to the end of a long journey. Of course, the truth is, seems can be a bit of a deceiving word in this case, though, because not only is there a lot of excitement in this volume, we do know that there's another Manticore Ascendant book coming out shortly. There's going to be a sixth Star Kingdom book coming out. David has got his team to take over if and when he retires. And we're actually going to be seeing some of those people's writing here in this anthology today, I believe. And I know David had teased some of the stuff in this book in our last interview, or the interview before that. I'm not sure which. But that said, I do have to start this book out with a bit of a warning. This book was released in, November, I think, last year? November 25?
It seems right.
So it's not been that long, is my point. This is the first time I've really felt it necessary to make a spoiler warning. If you haven't read the book and you're planning to, this is close enough to the publication date that, you might want to take that into account, because just by the nature of this podcast, spoilers are impossible to avoid. And while this has been true with all of the other books, it's going to affect a wider crowd than it has in the past. So consider yourself warned. And you know something that occurred to me?
What's that?
This is the first book where all three of us are coming into it fresh for the first time.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah, good point.
So it's going to be fun from that perspective. And with that said, Jim, I'm going to give you the opportunity to get us set to go.
Fair enough. So, from the back of the book, in Honor Harrington's day, the Star Kingdom of Manticore is the wealthiest star nation on a per capita basis in the entire galaxy. It is home to magnificent cities. Its planets, oceans, and seas and skies are open to its people, yet they have maintained the beauty and the magnificence of their natural habitats. But that was always not true. Pioneers, especially interstellar pioneers, must be tough, smart, and self-reliant. And the people who built the Star Kingdom knew that. They prepared carefully for their enormous voyage, incorporated every measure they could think of, and even so, their new worlds did their best to kill them all. They very nearly succeeded. As the plague years pushed the human interlopers into the very brink of survival and forced them to grow and change in ways they never could have anticipated. In the process, they became the people who could one day produce Honor Harrington, Elizabeth Winton, and the remarkable people willing to stand in the path of the People's Republic of Haven's insatiable advance, and to ally with the Republic when both of them learned who their true enemy was. In many ways, That stand was the inevitable result of a star nation that learned early on that what truly matters is the way one faces the challenges the universe throws at one. These are the stories of people who learned that lesson and met and triumphed every challenge of their new homes. Well, there it is.
Nice. There it is.
So, JP, what can you tell us about this?
Well, just a few admin or special notes. This is the 8th anthology, for those that are counting, in the Worlds of Honor set. And as you guys mentioned, it's the most recent one. It was published in November of 2025, coming in at an original hardcover length of 272 pages. I dare say one of the shorter books that Dave has had his hands on at times.
Thank God for that in the state I'm in today.
Right. It contains 5 new stories written by a total of 6 authors, and we'll cover who wrote what when we discuss each of those stories. As mentioned, I think one of you guys mentioned it, but maybe not. I'm going to say it just to be sure. There's an author's note at the beginning of this book, and it's worth reading because it does address some of the things that David is doing through these stories relative to the greater Honorverse timeline. And those are the notes that I have.
With excellent. That,
I'm going to hand back to you, Jim.
Okay, so we're going to definitely, once again, there are going to be tons of spoilers here for those of you who have not read this book. So as Hank Davis says, you've been warned. All right. So anyway, the first story of this collection is called One Controllable Step, and it is written by Marissa Wolf. Here's how it goes. When a virus hits Manticore, people begin getting sick and many are dying. The medical system in Landing is soon overwhelmed, so they call on help from Beowulf. A team of scientists head for the Star Kingdom and arrive as the pandemic is declared a plague. The virus causing the plague strikes indiscriminately, and whomever contracts the disease eventually ends tragically. The team from Beowulf, led by Sophia Abayani Reyes and Dr. Logan Burroughs, the Earl of Basingford, works feverishly but is thwarted because of the way the virus constantly mutates. Not only does it mutate, it also jumps to other planets, including Sphinx. After 3 years and thousands of deaths, Sophia and Owen Mitsotakis discover a particular trait of the virus and create a vaccine, saving the Star Kingdom from almost certain extinction. Well, there it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll roll right in with the background. Just one nugget really there. The dates for this story where it fits in the Honorverse are May 1481 through about November 1484 PD. And I'll add this in as well. I think this is the first contribution we've seen from Marissa Wolf.
Yes, and it won't be the last. One thing I do need to add in about the dates. This book corrects a lot of dating errors in the Honorverse as a whole, as far as continuity. The death, Roger Winton's death, founding dates, when Winton and Gregory became crown prince and princess. So there's a lot of little corrections that were made in this. You can assume that this is the actual the correct canon.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. I'll jump right into themes then as well. And there is only one that I'm going to note, and then over to you guys if there are any others, and that is the plague itself. We've heard a lot about it as we've taken this journey through the Honorverse. We're aware that it's a significant event in Manticore's history, and now we are finally getting some volume of details on what that plague was about, what it was like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we were saying all along, especially during the Stephanie Harrington books, that we wanted to know more.
Yeah.
And we got more.
Yes, we did.
So, all right. Well, I will go ahead and start off with my impressions. Excellent story. The tone of the story was somewhat depressing, yet optimistic. I love the way the scientist searching for a cure never gave up, no matter how many times they were disappointed with failure to discover the nature of the virus. The story was hammered home with the deaths of people from the poor all the way up through the ruling class. So it was very realistic. I have a quote. When Sophia gets sick, she's working right up to the last minute of her life and is close to a breakthrough. Owen insists she allow him in her sealed lab to help, and he is also dying. And here's what they say. Doesn't matter much where I die, Mitsotakis, as long as this gets done. Then unlock the door, pleading. That was the note in his voice she couldn't place. How strange. The two of us will be faster than one. My console here is hooked to yours. We're Sophia Ogbeana Reyes. If you don't let me in, I'm going to spend the rest of both of our lives banging on this door. Now, how will that help anyone? What? She meant to ask out loud, but coughed instead. If Owen were here with her, they'd have it. She knew they would, but we lost Santos before dawn. I registered positive twice, too. If I'm going to die anywhere, Soph, it's with you, and we're sure as hell gonna beat this thing first. Together. Let me in. One controllable step, and she unlocked the door.
And we get the name of the story.
Yes. All right. What about you, JP?
Well, as you mentioned, it's not really a happy story, but I thought it was great. I've been craving this kind of information, what this story provides to us, for a long time, and hope there's more story to come in the future that covers the plague years. Glad the book started strong with such a good story. I also have a quote. And this is a conversation between Senior Chief Petty Officer Abram Tudev and Donald Cruz and Connie Sato Bautista. They're all plague docs from the Beowulf. Precaution is wisdom, doctors. Perhaps it will be better this time, but either way, it will be quite brief. Tudev tipped his mug toward them with a smile. And once we're in normal again, it will take only a short time for the crew to have the ship oriented. I'd imagine there will be a few pending messages in a holding pattern waiting for us, and then we'll be able to establish near real-time communications fairly quickly. 10 to 11-minute delay each way. Donald put his hand to his heart at the glances he received. What? I read. And retained as well, yes, Tudev drank again. You've got a good crew here and an excellent astrogator. That's the good old arrogance of training talking, not unfounded bias. We'll come out exactly where Astro Control expects us to be, and the delay should be about 10.5 minutes. Until then, keep not murdering. With a sly smile, Connie stretched back in her seat and arguing about proteins and RNA strands and ribosomes. And in the midst of a dark story, that made me chuckle when the line hits, until then, keep not murdering.
Yeah.
Raul.
Okay, I'm going to say, first of all, this is a rather depressing story to discuss while you're sick. Especially since it's an everyone dies kind of story, which really gets to me. In a way, I'm glad they got this one through first. But I have to say, it is a very good story. And since I'm kind of in the field, I have to know that it really does reflect the mindset of actual scientists and healthcare providers that have been boots on the ground or on the front lines or doing any sort of pioneering research. In fact, I'll also add one thing to in some ways it actually hits home, and that's actually going to be what connects to my quote. I do have a quote for this. Use whatever word or concept you want, Ogbeana. I know it was real to you when you came to the planet instead of staying up on the Orpheus. I know it was real all along, but now it's personal. Has it ever been personal for you before? Of course it had. Her baby brother was why she'd gone to medical school in the first place. so very long ago, so very far away. The research, no, she whispered the word, but it scraped her throat raw nevertheless. Was that truth a betrayal of everyone else who had died, of Gregory's unflinching choice to leave the lab and work in the hospitals? That's something I really relate to, because in a lot of ways, there's parts of my history that it parallels, and it's part of what directed my career path and also part of what almost ruined my life. If we've got listeners from the old Babylon Project podcast, I think I shared this story back then on the episode with that was kind of similar to this, where the macabre race got largely wiped out. But back in another life, I was the senior clinical scientist for a small company that was pioneering those defibrillators that you see hanging all over the place. One of a few companies that was doing that. What set me on that path was an incident in the 1980s when I was on the hospital side, still in college, and a patient that I knew the background of went into V-fib and died. And the short version of this was a completely needless, completely preventable death, and it should have been identified at the time of the incident. The patient was on a monitored bed, and it was almost 28 minutes before the event was identified. Even then, it was 14 minutes before it was identified. It should have been within 30 seconds to a minute, and it took another 28 minutes for the patient to die after the response. I know the patient's background. If they had gotten a proper response, that patient would have lived, would have gotten an implantable defibrillator and continued his life. I documented it. I passed it along upstream. I was told it would be taken care of, and I made the mistake of letting myself be shut up about it. And I made an oath at that point, never again. And I ended up with a burnt-out thyroid from radiation damage in the EP lab as a result. It did some serious damage to my relationship with my wife. I don't know if I would make the same choice again, but I understand it being personal from that perspective.
Yeah.
So anyway, on a happier note, hey, at least now we know the history of the Basingford Medical Center and the Honorverse.
Yes.
So I am going to pass this on to you gentlemen for ratings.
Okay. Of course, I gave it a thumbs up. That wasn't a difficult decision.
A thumbs up from me as well.
Yeah, just a good solid thumbs up for something that hits home.
All right. All right, next up, we have a story called Deadly Delusions by Jane Linscold.
She's so cool.
Oh, gosh, yeah. This was something else. Okay. A burned-out sheriff's deputy, Arvin Earhart, resigns his position. He has seen too much death, mostly from natural disasters on the planet Sphinx. While he learns to cope with his ghosts, he works numerous jobs where he is able to work with his hands, mostly as a mechanic. Finally, he finds a position with Bioneering, working with Dr. Mariel Ubel as his supervisor. He repairs huge harvesting machines when they break down, and they seem to do so quite often. Arvin also has learned to study the plant life in the area of Bioneering and their camp, and gathers a great deal of helpful data. Meanwhile, a tree cat called True Stalker watches the activities of the humans in the area, including Arvin. The cats are aware of the possibility of becoming bonded with humans, so True Stalker is careful to keep his distance and stay hidden as he works his assignment. Elsewhere, a pair of sisters, Jeannie and Erica Beauship, grow up with different ideas about life. Jeannie is interested in environmental issues and the protection of wildlife, and her other ambition is to bond with a tree cat like Stephanie Harrington has. She also carries a lot of angst against Stephanie. Erica seems to have a more pragmatic concern of earning a living for her and her family. Jeannie is concerned with the expansion of the Bioneering encampment in the forest and how they may be causing harm to the environment. Erica applies for a position with the company and is very angry when she is turned down. While their ideas are in opposition, both believe it is their job to cause problems for Dr. Ubel's operation and make plans for retribution. They cause havoc in the compound by planning to remotely make the automated harvesters run amok. Erica devises a way to make this happen. When they hatch their plan, it seems even more effective than they thought it would be. The tree cats in the area watch while the machines cause damage to the Bioneering compound. Arvin, the only person on site, tries to mitigate the attack. In the process, he appears to build a relationship with True Stalker. Well, there it is.
That was a wild scene, too, when the machines are running rampant.
Yeah, broke right through the wall.
I'll jump onto the background and themes. Just a few here. This story happens when Stephanie Harrington is about 11 years old. So that should put that. I didn't have the year, but that gives you an estimate on when this is occurring. For the themes, of course, Bioneering, the company or the organization, which we've seen in the past, so we're getting a little more on those guys. Tree cats and adopting humans. In this story, Arvin, one of Dr. Ubel's henchmen, ends up getting adopted. And then, again, the plague. It touches on this story through Jeannie, a character who is somewhat fanciful, especially after surviving the plague years. So we're seeing the impact of the plague now here when young Stephanie Harrington was actually young Stephanie Harrington.
Yeah. So she was 11, which is, I believe, the same age when she bonded with her tree cat companion.
So what we have known as the beginning of the story, but now we're getting more info around that. Yeah, that seems right. Raul, do you remember? Was she 11?
Something like this. This was very early.
Yeah.
In it. One other theme that I have to add in this, I know we try to avoid things that can be too easily considered political, and in this story, Jane makes that almost impossible to do. But I have to respect the way she broaches the topic of eco-terrorism and kind of dives in the difference between conservationism and environmentalism. With that kind of activism. Nice job, Jane. Very, very well done in how she did it.
Yeah. All right. So I guess we can talk about impressions and quotes and things.
Yes, indeed.
What an amazing story Jane has crafted in this one. I love the way she covered all the characters' points of view and how quickly she made me care about them. This is one of the absolute best stories I have ever read. Short stories, I should say. And if I were an English teacher, I would use this in class as an example of superior short story writing. It's just amazing. I do have a quote. This is, Arvin is healing inside, and he's been having bad dreams while he heals from his PTSD. But at one point, when he was actually having a good dream for a change, he is rudely awakened by the sisters' mayhem. Okay. Three things awoke Arvin from a dream in which Chief Shelton of the SFS was awarding him with a basket of assorted cheese and cat toys as a thank you for his contributions to our awareness of the richness of Sphinx's biome. The first was a crashing, thudding sound. The second was the whir of cutting blades on high. And the third was something screaming in raw terror.
High drama.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And JP?
I enjoyed this story. Actually, really enjoyed it. And some of the surprises that it delivered. There were a few times that some of the characters felt kind of momentarily recycled. But that could have been me. For example, in her jealousy, Jeannie at times reminded me a lot of young Trudy. If we think back on
Miss
Trudy, but not at all saying, oh, this is actually the case, right? That the character was just recycled, but there were kind of hints of it there at times. It didn't diminish the story for me though. And no quotes. Over to you, Raul.
Okay. One of the reasons that I don't generally like short stories is that they always have this sense of being rushed or contrived to me. And I know I've complained about this on Jane's stories, and it's not her fault. It's the nature of a short story and kind of why I prefer novels. And it bothers me more with her than it does with other short stories. The reason it does is because I love her storytelling so much. My ship of the imagination shows me what this could have been if they had let her make a full-blown novel out of it. I just loved the story. I would have... This was definitely a case of leave you wanting more. Very well done, and very much another big like for me. I do have a quote from the Tree Cat discussion that I just absolutely loved. It just struck me. Maybe two legs did hunt each other. Was there a season for such then? The people had learned that the normally mild temper horned blades became very aggressive during the season when the males competed for mates. Perhaps two legs were the same. If so, knowing what times of the year to stay clear of them could mean the difference between a friendly encounter and a tragedy. All in all, it seemed the more people learned about two legs, the less they knew. I just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the reason I would have loved to see this as a full-blown novel so much, because I think the Star Kingdom Book 6 that's upcoming is going to be the last land of it. And I'm going to be very, very, very sad if that's her last contribution to the Honorverse.
Ugh.
I love her storytelling, and I just want more of it. So as to ratings, I think it's pretty clear where mine lies. I'm going to go ahead and ask you guys.
Definitely a thumbs up.
Another thumbs up from me.
And obviously a big one from me.
All right. So we're running perfect thumbs ups all the way through so far. All right. The third story in this anthology is probably my favorite. It is called, and it's because of this title. I mean, I wanted to go straight to this one when I opened up the book just because of the title. The Great Condiment Caper by Jacob Hollow with Thomas Pope. Okay. On board the Ad Astra, the first ever completely Manticoran-built dreadnought, there is a bit of a problem. Mysteriously, a pallet of precious material has gone missing. It is a necessary element to maintaining good morale on board the ship, and the ship dare not sail without it. The item missing is barbecue sauce. Oh, but not just any plain old barbecue sauce, no. What has been ghosted is the preferred condiment of thousands in the Star Kingdom. Dempsey's Sweet and Spicy Barbecue Sauce. It is a necessary ingredient in the shipwide treat called Chicken Finger Friday. Shipboard morale will certainly be diminished should this palate full of pleasure not be located, and young ensign Edward Saganami is put in charge of tracking it down and restoring it to its proper place. Saganami employs skills to rival the great Sherlock Holmes and Philip Marlowe to break the great condiment caper wide open, only to learn that it was a prank hatched by a crewman who wanted to impress a woman. Perhaps this alone would have been enough to have the academy named after him, but it is only the beginning of Saganami's long, illustrious career. Well, there it is.
Oh, God.
Good stuff.
Your comments were almost as fun to hear as the story.
The little things that keep military morale up, right? Barbecue sauce.
Uh-huh.
Chicken Finger Friday. Yeah. So, background. We mentioned Eddie, as he's called in here, Eddie Saganami, covers a few key events in his early career on board the Ad Astra as a logistics officer. And we learned that the other element of this big chicken finger barbecue sauce caper was that Eddie's assignment to figure out what happened was a bit of a test for his young leadership skills. Theme-wise, professional military relationships between junior officers, Eddie, and senior NCOs. Good senior NCOs are particularly valuable in the early development of junior officers. That's not a book thing. That is the real world. We see some of that here, how those senior NCOs kind of guide this youngster along. And a little bit of a silly crisis on the surface. But as I mentioned, this turns out to be a test of Ensign Saganami's leadership abilities. And the fun in the story, or part of the fun, is us getting to watch how he handles this awkward assignment, and he seems to do really well, as we see at the end. Any other themes from you guys before we jump into impressions? Mm.
No, I think I'm good.
I'm handing off to you, Sir Jim.
All right. So, the hits just keep on coming in this book. This was another good story with a huge sense of humor. I enjoyed reading about Edward Saganami's story. As an ensign aboard a big ship, we don't get a lot of his legendary character during the series beyond a mention here and there, but how cool is it to get a story about the person the Academy is named after as a junior officer? Yeah. This was just a fun read all the way around. And I do have a quote, and I preface it by saying, "Behind every great man, Saganami already knew he didn't want to be just another engineer. He wanted to lead engineers, which was why he saw himself as the chief engineer of a starship, perhaps even commander of a space station like Hephaestus. He and Heather, his high school sweetheart turned wife of 3 years, had once discussed his potential exit from the Navy. They both wanted kids, and he wanted to be a full-time dad, which meant, to him at least, an eventual shift to a planet-side career on Griffin. At the time, it made a lot of sense to him, especially given Heather's involvement in Griffin politics. With his engineering degree and Royal Manticore Navy experience, he'd be well-equipped to find a job close to home, and he'd be there as the two of them raised their kids. To his surprise, Heather had opposed the decision. "The Navy always needs good officers," she said, "and that's what you are going to be, Eddie. And it's not likely you'll be deployed somewhere completely outside the Star Kingdom, for goodness sake. Besides," she'd added with a quick, mischievous smile, "I knew about your other mistress before we married."
Yep.
Over to you, JP.
Oh, gosh. Oh, man. Well, I thought it was a very good and very entertaining story that shows us what young Edward Saganami was like. The young man was sharp right out of the chute. And I've got a quote as well. This is dialogue between Saganami and other crew on the ship. And I'll just say this: Saganami knows his Sun Tzu. "Are the chicken fingers really that big of a deal? If anything, Arkovich was understating the problem," Hargood said. "The crew is going to be pissed. Long Winter," which is the name of the exercise they're running, "Long Winter will live up to the name if you can't find their sauce." That's what I feared. Saganami took another sip. I was kind of hoping he'd blown this out of proportion. "Oh, we're not talking about complete pandemonium here, but I don't want to see this ship while it's going through sauce withdrawal. The line between order and disorder lies in logistics," Saganami quoted. Hargood's eyes lit up, and he raised a thoughtful finger. He kept that pose for several seconds, then said, "Tanakov? Sun Tzu. Dang it!" Hargood snapped his fingers. "I could have sworn that one was Tanakov. You must be thinking of those who ignore logistics quickly become experts at disappointment, chaos, and death. Normally in that order." There is our young lieutenant, or our young ensign, not even a lieutenant yet.
All right. Raul.
Okay. I guess I'm the only one with the cojones enough to call it like it is. The whole premise of this story is completely 100% lame. Everyone knows that the God intended dip for chicken fingers is ranch dressing. If you want a bit of a kick, you use a spicy ranch. If you want a real treat, mix a few drops of Cholula with the ranch. It's better than buffalo sauce on wings. Barbecue, honey mustard, blue cheese. No, those are the dips of heathens.
I've
said what has to be said.
By the way, yours truly here puts sriracha sauce on his chicken fingers. I'm a super heathen.
Sriracha is good. It's really good. I ended up on my own mixing Cholula and ranch. And we just didn't have a spicy ranch at the time. And that's what I kind of wanted at that particular day. And JP, you've got to try it sometime. I'm sure you're familiar with Cholula.
I am.
There's a very unique flavor to that that just does things.
Yeah, just give me a bottle of original Sweet Baby Ray's and I'm good to go.
Also, a good sauce.
With anything. Sauce.
Or by itself.
Yeah, just upend the bottle and squeeze. Forget the chicken.
I think we derailed you, Ro. We hijacked your comments.
Actually, this is a very, very fun story. Now, you know there has to be a lot of behind-the-scenes inside jokes here, especially when you look through it and you see all of the little Tuckerisms and stuff. There's tips of the hat to Star Wars. There's tips of the hat to Star Trek. There's tips of the hat to even Babylon 5. We really need to corner Dave on this one at some point, because I suspect the entire story is one big Tuckerism. One thing I do recognize definitely out of it is the name of the ship. For those of you who don't know, Ad Astra is a gaming company. Ad Astra Games, for those of you who were role-play gamers, is the publisher for Traveller, one of the oldest and best established role-playing games and the first science fiction role-playing game. It is also the publisher of the Sagarami Island Tactical Simulator, the Honor Harrington Honorverse combat simulation game, of which apparently you can get again. I think it's like a $100 set. And they've got these beautiful sets of lead miniatures of the battle of the different ships. It's a fascinating thing. So calling that had to be what calling the ship Ad Astra was no accident.
Well, Ad Astra comes up a lot lately, even and recently quite a bit. It is also the title of a choral piece that was published, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago that was just awesome. I even made my choir sing it, and they loved it. The Starfleet Academy in the Star Trek universe, Ad Astra per Aspera, which means from the stars comes knowledge, I think. So Ad Astra is a thing that's been around and is going around quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It was also the motto of the U.S. Space Force today.
Uh-huh. So some quotes and then a final comment. My first quote, barbecue sauce. Ensign Edward Saganami struggled not to make a face. When I hit that line, I was hooked. I was completely hooked on the story.
Yep.
Of course, that's also the very first line of the story. Now, my second quote. Saganami took a moment to rub his temples and take a deep breath. So, let me get this straight. You stole 600 liters of naval property in the lame attempt to impress a young woman, all because she sometimes gives you extra portions. Felker looked down bashfully. Doesn't sound quite so smart when you put it like, Spacer, this is the single dumbest thing I have ever heard. Saganami snapped his arms up and pointed down the aisle. You put this pallet back where it belongs right this instant, and then you meet us outside, all three of you. Am I clear? I laughed so hard I spit on that line.
You know what this section made me think about? It made me think about McHale's Navy.
We may be the only people listening to this that know what that is.
Oh, I'm sure you can find it somewhere. But yeah, it's an old TV show, McHale's Navy, and they were the crew of this little PT boat was constantly getting in trouble for one thing or another that involved things like this. But yeah, that was a good one.
Okay, now
mischievous.
Yes.
A final comment. A year ago, I would have just blown this story off as, well, basically a McHale's Navy spoof comic. However, last fall, over Thanksgiving, my wife and I went to South Carolina, and we were at Charleston, and I took the captain's tour of the carrier Yorktown. Seeing the kitchens there, learning how so much more of how a massive vessel like that looked, and then realizing this is actually a small carrier by modern standards. Well, this story actually makes a hell of a lot of sense. It's not as utterly ridiculous as it might have seemed at the beginning, especially when you look at the way they fed those sailors, the way and those pilots, and just the way a naval ship operates, and some of the weird traditions and stuff like that that go into place. It's like, yeah, missing barbecue sauce really could have been a very big deal.
Oh, yeah. I have had friends who have had kids in the Navy, and they will, when they go on out to the Western Pacific and come back, family can go and fly out to like Hawaii and jump on the ship and ride it back to the West Coast. And I've been told those kitchens operate 24 hours a day because they never know when somebody's going to stop by and need a sandwich in a hurry because, you know, they've been on duty for however many hours and, you know, they're hungry or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, and they're huge, especially on something as massive as a carrier.
Yeah. Well, there's 6,000 people on those ships, some of those ships.
Yep.
Small cities.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad I didn't read the story until after that trip because I had so much more. I would have had, it gave me so much more appreciation of it.
This gives us a good, you know, part of what makes the story good and not just humorous is that there's really no reason for something like that to go missing. And I don't mean the sailor's motive for taking it. I mean, it's hard to lose something like that based on how the story unfolds and how they account for things and where stuff goes, which really made it interesting and then also made it funny.
And apparently there are pranks like that, things like this that go awry.
Yeah.
Hey, before we get into ratings, I failed to mention something that I want to do. You know, we talk about who wrote this story, Thomas Pope, a guy that we're familiar with and is, you know, a pillar of strength inside the Honorverse, but the other author was Jacob Hollow, and I think this was the first contribution we've seen from him. Not that it was a solo work, but I wanted to make sure we acknowledge that there were some for the Honorverse, some fresh talent on this story.
Mm. I think this is another name we probably won't see the last of.
Yeah.
So ratings, gentlemen.
Oh, thumbs up. I laughed.
Same. Same with me. Thumbs up.
Very solid thumbs up again.
All right. So story number four is called XO by Daniel Allen Butler. Okay. Aboard the HMS Ulysses, an emergency call goes out to send the ship's surgeon to the bridge. The executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Ellen D'Orville, is also summoned to the bridge where the scene is a grim one. The ship's commanding officer, Commander Nancy Piatt, has taken ill and will be relieved by Ellen. Her mission will be to get her commanding officer to hospital for treatment and await the assignment of a new commanding officer. Meanwhile, in a place described as a backwater to the backwaters of the galaxy, Manpower Incorporated is doing what they seem to do best. They find out the way places destabilize their governments and show them how genetic slavery can make their systems more profitable. One such planet that has succumbed to manpower's influence is the Torgau system. The Ulysses delivers her captain to the medical facility. Ellen learns she is to be the commanding officer of the ship and will be immediately dispatched on a mission to the Torgau system to participate in Operation Long Winter. Ellen's orders are to seek out and observe any suspicious activity there and report back, so future anti-slavery operations can be planned. The frigate is to be a hole in space, maintaining radio silence and gathering information only. They are specifically ordered not to engage any ships involved in slavery operations. While on station, the Gemini Adventurer, a manpower slave ship, enters the system and heads for Torgau. As ordered, Ulysses' crew observes and records but does not engage. It isn't long before another larger ship enters the system, and then, before it can be positively identified, disappears back into hyperspace. As Ellen and her crew puzzle over this mysterious activity, the larger ship appears again and is identified as the Cerberus, a known pirate ship that begins moving into the system to intercept Gemini Adventurer. Ellen is left with two choices. She can either follow her orders to the letter, allowing the pirates to take the slaver ship, or she can disobey her orders and engage the Cerberus to stop their nefarious activities. Her humanity will not allow her to just sit by and watch, so she sets her orders aside and moves to attack the pirates. Realizing the Ulysses, a small frigate, doesn't have a chance of winning a battle with the much larger Cerberus, she contacts the Torgauans and requests they send ships to assist while Ulysses keeps the Cerberus busy. Ellen's plan works, and she has done the right thing, but there are consequences for disobeying orders, even when it's the right thing to do. Ellen thinks her career is over until her commanding officer, Commander Calvin Scott Bragg, informs her there will be a reprimand placed in her file for disobeying orders, but there will also be a commendation placed there for upholding the ideals of the Royal Manticore Navy and the Star Kingdom of Manticore. Well, there it is. And over to you, JP, for some background information and themes.
Yeah, so for background, there's no date that I caught that was given specifically in the story. But we are seeing references to this same exercise or operation called Long Winter. I don't know that this is the same Long Winter that we just heard about with Ensign Saganami in the previous story, or if that is a recurring name of an event or exercise, like an annual event, an annual exercise or operation. But that's some connective tissue between these stories in terms of background. And then themes are history in general, no surprise since David is a historian, genetic slavery, and how slaves are viewed came out acutely in this story. But genetic slavery has run through lots of the Honorverse as a theme. Professional development, specifically here, if, when, and how to have a conversation about those in leadership that aren't challenges to good order and discipline, or that cross the line into insubordination or even fomenting insurrection, or perhaps even mutiny. So those delicate conversations that happen behind closed doors are quote unquote don't happen. Looked at differently, this addresses how to have those conversations that actually the quote used in the book was that we shouldn't have. It could also be tied into what's called professional dissent, which I think has come up at least once in earlier stories, not in this anthology. Another theme, civilian control of the military, and related, the military being used for political stunts was a phrase used in here. We've talked about this in the past, where politics impacts the military, whether it's policy decisions or the military being used as a political tool. But remember, from very early in our exploration of the Honorverse, and then several times following, we've referenced Clausewitz's famous quote about war, the act of war being a continuation of politics by other means. So this is showing up again as a theme here. And the last one is moral authority and how it's exercised when rules collide. And we see this dilemma occur for Lieutenant Commander D'Orville regarding laying low and unobserved in another nation's space and then taking direct action against slavers, which obviously didn't let her lay low and undetected or unobserved.
Yeah.
Did you guys see any others?
No, but, you know, some of the things that are emphasized here is that not following orders will have consequences, even if it's the right thing to do.
Right.
However, a good commanding officer will help shield a person from retribution for something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
context matters.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. So I will pick up with some impressions and quotes. Hey, this story fits so well in the Honorverse. My compliments to Mr. Butler, the author.
Yeah, by the way, I think his first showing in the Honorverse, is that correct?
I think so.
I don't remember seeing anything.
I believe so, yes.
I don't either, but it's been a long time. Who knows? I enjoyed the plot and that it mainly focused on the Ulysses and her crew. I thought the pacing was excellent and the characters were people I could care about. I was invested in this tale from the outset and did not want to put it down until I finished. Okay. And I do have a quote for this. This I put under the category of, I see what you did there. I love these little nods to other sci-fi franchises whenever they appear. So here it is. Ellen smiled at the back of Williamson's head. Relax, Senior Chief. I've got every confidence that Chief Engineer Conway has kept the compensator in tip-top shape. And if he hasn't, von Ohmstegen muttered just quietly enough that Ellen could pretend she hadn't heard him, we'll all be raspberry jam before we know it. The corners of Ellen's mouth threatened to quirk upward in amusement, but by the time she turned to face the XO, her expression was one of faint but unmistakable disapproval. I find your lack of faith in our chief engineer disturbing, Mr. von Ohmstegen, she announced.
Most excellent.
Yes. And how about you, JP?
This was my favorite story in the anthology. It tackled some World War II history as applied to times when we see these events unfold, specifically issues related to the Maginot Line of World War II. On a personal note, I love that we see a character smoking a classic briar pipe. Like we've seen characters in other novels smoking cigars, here we have the appearance of a cool
Yay.
Pipe. Pretty neat. Yes.
Nah, just chewing on your pipe.
Oh, okay. There were also some great pop culture tips of the hat, which, Jim, you already mentioned. I picked up on Curiouser and Curiouser, which was an Alice in Wonderland, something Alice said. I find your lack of faith disturbing from Star Wars. Just some cool stuff like that. Nice tip of the hat to Master Chief Petty Officer Weber as well. Nicely done, Daniel Butler. By the way, I believe this was his first contribution to the Honorverse, which I just mentioned a bit ago. And I definitely hope there's more from him. No surprise, since I said that this was my favorite story in the anthology. And then a few quotes. The first one is a conversation about the problem with static defenses. In practical terms, then, these circumstances translated into the title of the Torgau Bureau of Defense being a literal description of departmental function. The energies, resources, and manpower other star nations devoted to hyperspace navies were directed towards system defense forces that focused on the sole inhabited planet, which shared its name with its parent star. Massive fortified installations on a scale as ambitious as the legendary Maginot Line of pre-space Old Terra and fixed in position throughout the system by the laws of celestial mechanics, protected the homeworld of Torgau, along with the vital reactor mass refinery circling the seventh planet, a gas giant called Zeppelin, as well as the trading stations and most of the major mining facilities in the asteroid belt. The fatal flaw of the Maginot defenses, their lack of mobility, also existed, at least in theory, in the Torgau fortifications, although it was technically impossible to outflank them, which was the historical fate which befell the fabled Maginot fortifications. So there's your World War II history applied. Next quote is a discussion about what makes a junior officer a good first-time commander in command, not, by the way, the rank of commander. The thing is, I've seen the Navy from both sides, as a spacer and as an officer, and I've seen too many young officers get their first command and do some dumb arse stuff. You know, thinking right away that they had to prove something, that they had to show they deserved their command. Maybe completely forgetting that they can prove it just by getting the ordinary jobs done right. And then my final quote is a conversation between Lieutenant Commander Dorville and her Commodore about the moral struggle with some of the difficult decisions that she made. And this is kind of the accounting for things at toward the end of the story. The Commodore shook his head, clearly disgusted by that momentary lack of temerity. The Navy, the Star Kingdom, cannot infuse its officers with a specific set of moral duties and obligations and then expect those same officers to set aside those duties and obligations in order to satisfy light and transient political considerations. Yet, that was the position in which you found yourself, and your orders required you to sacrifice your sense of duty to the crown and your personal honor for the sake of someone else's political benefit and expedience. You had no legal right to disobey your orders, Ms. Dorville, and that is where you were wrong. At the same time, you were under the moral imperative to do just that, which is where you were right. Fortunately for the crown and the Star Kingdom, you recognized where your true duty lay. He flipped open the tobacco pouch and filled the battered briar, then struck one of the matches. Once he had the pipe lit to his satisfaction and was puffing away contentedly, he went on. I made this point rather as forcefully as I could to the First Space Lord, and it so happens that Admiral Spaeth agreed with me. She has, in fact, made those very arguments to the First Space Lord and Her Majesty herself. And that was my last quote.
Yeah. And see, I think we've talked about this concept before with old-time Navy ships. When you're out in the middle of the ocean somewhere, the captain of a ship must have the ability to make snap decisions like that without calling back for permission, because it's just right. It's just so impractical. And so
the next worst thing after somebody second guessing you in real time is the people telling you did it right or wrong after the fact.
Well, yeah, and you know, if things go right like they did in this case, you're a hero. And if you make the decision, no matter what the reason is, if the results are not desirable, then you're a goat.
Yep.
So, yeah. Raul, I think you're up.
Yeah. And first thing, I have to make a correction to my comments in the last, because this is the one that had the Star Wars, Star Trek, Babylon 5 references. There were a lot of Tuckerisms in the last one and a lot of inside jokes, but this one had those specifics. So the fans don't have to send a bunch of emails correcting me.
They can if they want, but you corrected yourself.
You know, my very first thought starting in the story is it kind of felt a little rough and I wasn't sure where things were going to be going. And my very, very first thought was absolutely 100% completely wrong. Damn, this was a real Weber level Onivers story right down to the death march at the end. It was a wonderful piece of work, and I really want to see more. One thing to note, like JP was pointing out, the story's full of Easter eggs, the Star Wars references, Star Trek, Babylon 5. It's the first appearance of a Weber in an Honorverse story. And am I the only one who couldn't help but hear Chief Engineer Jeff in Montgomery Scott's voice?
Meaning, no, you were not the only one.
I'm giving her all we got.
It was there.
It was there.
For those, you know, who have read the book, I took the speech mannerisms out so that I could read it without goofing it up. But yeah, that dude has an accent.
Yep.
I need to look up the honor story. I can't remember which one it was. Well, she got busted for doing the right thing the wrong way. Yeah. In almost the same way that Doraville did here.
Yeah.
So she's definitely got some common traits with the shining stars of RMN history.
You said not written by Weber, but this was definitely a Weber-esque Honorverse story.
Oh, and, completely.
And even see it in that, right? You see the things Honor has struggled with that other mm-hmm. people have too mm-hmm. in this case.
Yeah. No, this was an absolutely wonderful read. As far as quotes are concerned, damn it, JP, you stole all my quotes again.
You're welcome for my service.
With my voice, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could say we planned it that way.
Yeah. All right. Well, I gave it a thumbs up.
I gave it 2 thumbs up.
I have to say, JP, I did the same. This had to get a 2 thumbs up for me.
All right. Moving right along, the 5th installment in this anthology is called Crystal Singer's Song by David Weber. In 1926 PD, Honor is called to Sphinx. She is being called there by a treed cat named Crystal Singer, who explains she has something important to tell her and insists that it is also important to her personally. In 1496 PD, a pilot who is taking some rescue supplies to a family in need finds herself flying through a severe storm. When Aldona's aircraft is hit by lightning, she finds her electronics fried and useless. Not knowing exactly where she is, unsure of which direction she is heading, she is unable to use the stars for navigation. She makes her best guess in hopes that she will find an appropriate place to land. She does find land on an island that humans have not populated. She has little hope of rescue and has gone in the complete opposite direction of her planned course, so she is forced to use her wits and the wreckage of the plane to survive. At first, believing she was alone, she prepares herself to live a life of solitude, but that isn't to be the case. The island she calls Castaway Island is populated by a lot of wildlife, including tree cats. The cats observe her, and she notices them watching and begins to observe them back. While exploring her surroundings, she encounters a young tree cat under attack from some local predatory birds. Aldona uses her shotgun to stop the attack. The cat has been injured and would certainly have perished had Aldona not intervened and saved its life. Aldona befriends the what she calls tree foxes, and they teach each other various skills. She lives a long life and has never been alone or lonely thanks to the companionship of the entire tree cat clan. She dies content. She has lived a full, happy life. Returning to 1926 PD, Crystal Singer finishes telling Aldona's story, revealing why it is significant to Honor. Well, there it is. Okay, and how about some background information and themes, JP?
Yeah, so you kind of hit the background in that this story occurs between 1496 and 1551, but it also bounces briefly to 1926, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
The theme that I'm pointing out is tree cats and human history on Sphinx.
Yeah. I would add to that survival, by using the resources available to you.
Yes. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's some themes. Raul, if you didn't have any others, let's jump into impressions.
No, nothing additional on the themes, but a lot to say in my comments.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So when I started reading this story, I was confused. I was puzzled over why honor was even mentioned since the plague years were centuries in the past. But almost immediately, when I got into the first chapter of this featuring the Castaway Island tale, I got where the story was going, or at least I thought I did. The plot twist at the end of the story was so subtle, yet so powerful, I wept at the end. And even though I wanted more, the ending was perfect. Well done, David, and well done to all involved in this project. I don't have any quotes, but don't miss this one. Yeah. How about you, JP?
With this story, I can say, at least for me, there wasn't, am I say with this story, meaning that we're on the last one, there wasn't a bad story in the collection. And this is my second favorite story in this anthology. Two particularly cool things in here for me. First, we get an insight into how and why memory singers decide what to remember. I don't think it had ever been covered before if they can remember everything or how it works. And in fact, we learn here they do have a maximum capacity, and then they have to decide what's remembered and what isn't. And then second, Aldona is an SFS ranger who connects with the Tree Cats in what is a double isolation. They're what's known as the Lost Nest Clan, and our main character, Aldona, is literally lost when she crashes on the island that clan is on during a storm. And then perhaps best of all, maybe, I'm thinking it's best of all, we learn who SFS Ranger Aldona actually is. Should I say it?
Yes.
Sure, go ahead.
We warn people of spoilers. Aldona,
yep,
is Aldona Zivonic, older sister of Alexander Zivonic, Carl's and Carl's aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a fun and exciting story, but it ends on a heavy note. Jim, you mentioned it made you emotional. It was an emotional ending, but not a sad ending. It actually was a very satisfying ending. But
yes. Man, yes.
Power packed, hits you right in the gut. Even so, it was not a silly drama.
No.
Like you said, don't miss it. Don't miss it. This is a cool story. And I don't have any quotes either.
It was very detailed in how she went about surviving and everything. And I got lost in the story. I'll tell you what, I did not lose hope at all that she would be rescued. So that was a twist at the end for me.
Yeah.
That she didn't live on, or that she was not rescued. So
that was, David wrote that in a way, I think, that she never lost hope, and so we don't with her. Like, she planned for eventual rescue, and we watch that in the background morph into preparedness not to be rescued to I will not be rescued. But she never loses hope. She just lives, and she lives well, and she's got the cats around her. And it was really neat. Really, really neat.
Yes.
Thanks, David.
Yeah.
Darn you. More good stuff.
Yeah. How about you, Raul?
Heavy's not the word I would have picked. I think heartwarming, bittersweet, or another way of putting it is David does heartwarming as good as any K-drama, which is a genre that loves this kind of this type of storytelling. I remember David was teasing the story in one of the interviews, and I can't remember which, but the point of it was there's actually a double tie-in between Honor and the Tree Cats, and that it was the Zervonic is that tie. The story was sort of a mix of a Robinson Crusoe and Swiss Family Robinson sort of tale. And I've got to say that latter, Swiss Family Robinson, was one of my all-time children's book favorites. I love that story. First book I think I ever wore out physically. The name of the memory singer is not an accident. Crystal Singer, are you folks familiar with Anne McCaffrey's novels, the Crystal Singer series?
No, I'm afraid I'm not.
No, not very familiar at all.
Okay, we will definitely have to make a correction to this one. Crystal Singer, Killashandra is an opera singer that has a flaw in her voice and ends up using that to mine and shape these crystals that are necessary for interstellar travel. But it comes at a price. It has a lot of benefits with that kind of symbiotic bond with the planet, and you can't leave. But at some point, you will lose all of your memories, often going mad in the process. The flip side, at the end of the series, though, she actually discovers something that wipes the residue from the crystals away, and it makes it possible to basically save your memories. So remember, David had a special relationship with Anne. There's a very real tribute there that just kind of hits you in the heartstrings when you think of it that way. It's a wonderful little trilogy that's worth everyone reading. As far as quotes, you know, it's a hard one to pick a quote for. Everything goes so well together, and there's such a consistent flow to everything. It's almost impossible to pick out something that stands out more than the rest. And I'm saying that in the best possible way. But there was one bit that really touched my heart as someone who's raised a child who's now in his young 20s. And for me professionally, I'm at the age of passing my knowledge on to the next generation. So for some crazy reason, this really just hit me. This is Aldona writing in her journal. I'm not going to live forever. I expect I'll live longer than I might have because of you guys. If today's anything to go by, you're the kind of neighbors who drop by to help with the chores, and I really appreciate that. But eventually, I'll be gone, and so even if nothing broke in the meantime, it would, but even if it didn't, you guys would be stuck with tools you couldn't use. And that would be even worse if you started relying on those tools. So I'm not going to be handing out vibroblades or powered tillers or countergraph belts. But you know what? There's a bunch of stuff I can teach you, show you, that'll make your lives easier, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to teach you everything I can that you will be able to keep doing when I'm not here. And maybe, just maybe, that'll be at least a little bit of payback for the fact that you wonderful people are going to make sure I'm never really alone again. That just really hit me.
And it was awesome. It struck me hard that she referred to them as people.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't, oh, you know, the cool, you animals or you, you know, something other descriptor. She says, you wonderful people.
Yeah. And so what is going on in the other series, in the Stephanie Harrington series? There's this argument going on and questions and everything else. And this person just gets it.
Yep. It probably took that isolation for her to fully realize what these creatures are.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of life wasn't pressing in on her at that point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they become her neighbors, as she says. They become people. She doesn't see cats. She sees friends, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or foxes.
Yeah.
I said cats.
Yeah. Tree foxes.
Yeah. Yep. It was really nice seeing a little bit of Honor, and she was a perfect person in the context of the story. It was just an absolutely sweet wrap-up to an absolutely fantastic anthology.
Yep.
So I really loved this entire book of stories overall.
Yeah. I rated it thumbs up easily.
I did as well.
Ditto. Easy thumbs up.
All right. So that brings us to our rating for the overall book in itself. I rated it 5 outstanding examples of outstanding writing skill.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. How about you, JP?
I gave it a solid 5, reflecting 5 great stories in this anthology. And if I had to get more creative, I'd, you know, well, no, I'm going to leave it there.
Yeah.
5 great stories, rating of 5.
5 excellent short stories was my rating.
Great. Well, overall, that makes the math kind of easy. We call this a 5, and it is all of that in a bottle of Dempsey's sweet and spicy barbecue sauce on top, I'll tell you what.
Maybe 5 bottles of Dempsey's barbecue sauce, right?
Yes. So this is a new book, as we've noted. And on Goodreads, we have a 4.67 overall rating with 337 people calling or writing in. And on Amazon, it is a 4.8 with 484 ratings. So
nice.
Yeah. So the readership is kind of low on this. So hopefully you heed our warnings from earlier. Probably too late to tell you now. Don't listen to this show unless you are ready to be spoiled.
But it's not too late to tell you guys, definitely read this book.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
It's worth it.
Okay. And on our next very exciting episode of Honorverse today, we will be discussing House of Steel by David Weber, along with a plethora of others. House of Steel contains a short novel from the early days of the Star Kingdom and focuses on a biography of Roger Winton III, his ascension to the throne of Manticore, and how he prepares Elizabeth for her reign, as well as the early days of the war with the People's Republic of Haven. Also included in this volume is an Honorverse companion that has a great deal of detailed information to aid in the understanding of the universe we all enjoy and love. And I'll tell you what, Raul, I'm a little upset with you. Huh? I wish I had known about this book at the beginning when we started this, rather than now when we're getting ready to close the show out as a regular project. I just skimmed through it. I just thumbed through it. And there is a lot of stuff included in there that might have been helpful. So the only shout out we have today is to Mr. Hank Davis of the TPE Network, a fun and informative podcast. Thank you, Hank. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. So any final comments, gentlemen?
None from me.
None, but looking forward to next time. We do need to, for those people who've been wondering what kind of shape the future of the Honorverse is going to be in, when and if David retires, this book, I believe, gives us a taste of that.
Yeah.
We do need to have a word with David about getting back on the show now.
Well,
yeah,
let's do it.
It's getting that time. And that said, I think that's everything I've got for now.
All right. Well, I've
actually survived.
In that case, say goodnight, JP.
Good night, JP.
Night, everybody.
So long, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Honorverse today. We welcome your feedback. Email us at honorverse@tpenetwork.com. We are a proud part of TPE Network. Visit us on the web at honorverse.net, on social media, or tpenetwork.com. You can subscribe to Honorverse today by visiting tpenetwork.com/subscribe. Visit TPE Network for the very best in podcasting. Opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts. They do not reflect the opinions or views of Bain Books, the authors, or TPE Network. Visit Bain.com for the best in science fiction. Many of their books are available from the Bain Free Library found at their site. Theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Valaha. Check his website found in the show notes for all your podcasting music needs.
and to ally with the Republic when both of them learned their true who, and to ally with the Republican with and to ally with the Republic when both of them learned their true enemy was who their damn. Thought I checked this.
It's been a while.
Yeah. And to ally with the Republican.
Don't laugh, Raul.
In many ways, that stand was the inevitable result of a star nation that learned early on what truly matters is the way one faces the challenges of the universe. One of those days.
Maybe two legs did hunt each other. Was there a reason for such then? The people had learned that normally mild temper hornblades become
Start again.
What happened?
You said reason instead of season.
Oh.